Greetings, Professor Jenkins. My name is Schubert A. Connor, Wisconsin, 1935. Please refer to your letter of June 4th and June 20th and mine of June 7th, 1984. This recording is being made on August 30th, 1984. I'm sorry that I've delayed it for so long, but here it is at last. I feel that my contribution would be trivial and of no significance or value to your work. But since I've promised, here it is. If you have any questions or wish any information regarding any of the topics discussed, please feel free to ask. I was born on a farm about 3.5 miles north of Kirksville, Missouri, the middle one of three children. At the age of 4, I was enrolled in the Model Rural School. This was an experimental school maintained on the campus and operated by the Kirksville Normal School. After 4 years, the school was closed and I was transferred to the demonstration school, which also was administered and operated by the KNS. Both the Model Rural School and the demonstration school were used to train future teachers. Students attending the normal school were assigned courses to teach in the demonstration school. Student teachers assisted the permanent teachers in the Model Rural School. At some time prior to 1925, the name of the Kirksville Normal School was changed to the Kirksville State Teachers College. It is now known as the Northeast Missouri State University. After being graduated from the 8th grade, I attended a high school at the KSTC for 1 year. This high school was closed in 1923, and I was transferred to the Kirksville High School in 1923, the same year. KSTC continued to offer high school courses during the summer, so by attending summer school, I accumulated 15 credits. This was sufficient to satisfy entrance requirements at the KSTC. I did not graduate from high school. In 1929, I was graduated from the KSTC with a major in chemistry and a minor in mathematics. Since KSTC was a teacher's college, a large number of education courses were required. During my senior year, my physics professor, John Hardy, suggested I try graduate school instead of taking a teaching position. I went to the University of Illinois and obtained a part-time teaching assistantship there. This was increased to a full-time teaching assistantship the following year. Midway of my second year, I was informed that because of my teaching, my assistantship would not be renewed. I completed the requirement for a master's degree in organic chemistry, and the next fall, I enrolled at the University of Wisconsin. The choice was made because Wisconsin had a very good organic chemistry department. I moved into a third-story room in a private rooming house located at the back of a drugstore at the corner of University and Park Avenues. During my first year, I studied organic chemistry under Professor Adkins. I had no assistantship, and Professor Adkins had none to offer me, but suggested that I talk to Professors Peterson and Fred in the College of Agriculture. They had nothing available at that time, but I did get a part-time job preparing media and cleaning up the laboratory for a course in soil microbiology taught by Professor Fred. Professor Riker had done important work on the pathology of a crown gall bacterium, an organism which produced an undifferentiated growth on apple tree roots, tomato stems, and many other plants. The unorganized character of the gall led Professor Riker to note the similarity between the plant galls and human cancer growths. He recognized that there was a huge potential field for research on crown gall and suggested to Professor Peterson that they cooperate on a biochemical research project. Professor Riker had a small grant sufficient to support me for the summer of 1932. He was able to obtain a grant for a research project during the following years from the International Cancer Research Foundation. Professor Peterson and Fred had formed a very productive association, and Professor Riker believed that chemistry could contribute much to plant pathology. Subsequent events have confirmed his views. Agrobacter tumefaciens, the crown gall organism as it is now called, has been the subject of many studies in molecular genetics. My graduate studies were concerned with the carbohydrate and nitrogen metabolism of this organism. Professor Riker was a plant pathologist and knew little chemistry. Professor Peterson had his own problems and staff and was located in another building. So I was quite on my own with no training worth mentioning in bacteriology or biochemistry. My contributions were trivial and inconsequential. The department was poorly equipped for biochemical research. Much of my time was spent locating or making the simplest types of equipment. There were plenty of beakers, Erlenmeyer flasks, and petri dishes, incubators, sterilizers, and microscopes, but little else. I had to construct condensers, extractors, thermoregulators for constant temperature baths, shaking machines, and various other items which were required in my work. I do not mean this to sound critical or bitter. The department was very well equipped for phytopathological research, but not for biochemical work. I intended to preface each section with the same title that you gave in your outline. I see now that I have not done this. The section coming up is item 2, Agricultural Chemistry and Plant Pathology Departments, relating to research assistantships. Research assistants were an important part of the plant pathology department. Much of the work required greenhouse and field work, and a major part of this work was done by graduate assistants. While some full-time, non-technical help was available, this was monopolized by the highest-ranking professors, and the others depended upon research assistants for much of the muscle work involved in the plant propagation required for phytopathological research. I believe the greenhouses were under the jurisdiction of Professor Walker. Hence, his assistants were able to obtain all the non-technical help required, sifting soil, filling flats, hoeing field plots, sterilizing clay pots, and so forth. Not all of the non-technical help required. They obtained most of the non-technical help, I should say. More than their share, perhaps, would be a better statement. I am now to the section on faculty. I know little or nothing of the efforts of the faculty members in obtaining funding. Professor Riker obtained some money from a special research fund of the University of Wisconsin and some from the International Cancer Research Foundation, I believe New York. Funds then, as always, were in short supply. I knew nothing of the details of the administration of the departments. Both Professor Kitt and Professor Hart were well liked by students and other professors. To my untrained eye, departments, agriculture, biochemistry, and plant pathology were well run. There was some friction between some members of the biochemistry department. Professor Elverton and Steenbach had acrimonious words at times. Professor Link criticized Professor Steenbach in his lectures, but he criticized faculty and members of other departments, and at one time was critical of what he called the cow-headed college committee. The committee opposed a suggestion of his to present an evening course in carbohydrate chemistry. Apparently, Professor Link won because I took the course. Of all the professor's courses which I took, those of Professor Peterson appeared to be the best organized. This despite the fact that many topics were assigned to students to present to the class. Professor Link's lectures also were good, but he spent too much time on unrelated introductory material. A girl in the stockroom asked me how I liked the carbohydrate course. I replied that I liked it, but that we hadn't been taught much chemistry yet because KP, that's the way we referred to Professor Link, was still blowing off steam. The remark got back to Professor Link, much to my chagrin. Professors Hart and Steenbach tended to ramble, and their lectures were not presented in a forceful manner. I took one course under Professor Riker, Methods in Plant Pathological Research, or Methods in Plant Pathology Research. Professor Riker was an excellent teacher, and his methods course should still be a requirement for students in their first semester of phytopathological research. Methods courses in other fields would be equally valuable. Professor Riker was an excellent writer, and his papers were well done. I could not write, so Professor Riker had a great deal of trouble with me trying to teach me the basic elements of good writing. I was an inept pupil. I resented his corrections and his insistence on rewording manuscripts time after time. Years later, I realized how valuable was the training he gave me. It is the old Dutch story, so soon old, so late smart. No discussion of the plant pathology department would be complete without mentioning the contributions of Eugene Herling, H-E-R-R-L-I-N-G. Gene was a handyman around the department. He was a department draftsman, photographer, confident, time a dishwasher and general helper. So far as I know, all of the photographs of plants, field plots, photomicrographs, and so forth were taken by Gene. He was responsible for the photographs which appeared in the publications of the plant pathology department, and possibly, I think, also for the horticulture and maybe agronomy department also. He was a very good-natured person and always ready to help. He shared the dark room with the agronomy department, who used it rarely, and all other members of the plant pathology department. I believe he eventually received the rank of assistant professor. I'm now on the section of administration. I know nothing of the administration of the two departments. The plant pathology building was kept neater than was the agricultural chemistry building, but this may have been a result of the greater number and density of the biochemistry students. Next section is relation among students and faculty members. I am not aware of any formal clubs which existed in either department. There may have been some in the biochemistry department, but I was a member of none. The plant pathology department held a seminar once a week at which students discussed their own research results or outstanding research carried out in other schools. Tea and cookies were served before the seminar. I know of no other department which did this. It was a very nice custom, and I hope it is still done. The tea was prepared by graduate students appointed each week. Regardless of who was appointed, he always made the tea too strong. Professor Kitt would always ask for half and half, please. Half tea and half hot water. Most of the other faculty members did the same. On a few occasions, Professor Riker invited his students to his home for dinner. These were always very enjoyable occasions, and on some Saturday afternoons, he would take some of us for a ride through southern Wisconsin. I'm now on a section, Department Graduates, number two. My career has been very low key and quite uneventful. The first year after receiving my degree was spent at the University of Wisconsin, continuing my PhD thesis work. Jobs were few and far between in those days. Some PhDs who were working in the department when I started in 1932 were still there when I left in 1936. My first job was with the Roman Haas Company of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The plant was located at Bristol, Pennsylvania. I carried out studies on enzyme production and application. My only significant discovery was that pectinase was composed of two enzymes, one which split pectin into relatively large molecules and a polygalacturonase which split pectin down into galacturonic acid units. The work was not published, and subsequent investigators have discovered and published the same phenomenon. Not long after, my work was diverted to the enzymatic conversion of cornstarch, not a research project at all, merely one of endless testing. I was dissatisfied with the work and left to take a job with the Johnson Research Foundation. This work was carried out at the Johnson Suture Corporation, a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson. Johnson Suture Corporation was a small company located in Chicago. It had practically no laboratory equipment. I was supposed to work on the effect of enzymes on sheep intestine during the processing in the sutures. After about a year, the manager of Johnson Suture Corporation asked that I be transferred to his company to take charge of both of the search and control laboratories. In 1945, the end of the war was imminent. The manager of Johnson Suture Corporation was fired, and so was I not long after. 9 days later, I had a job with National Distillers Products Corporation, Cincinnati, Ohio. A position I held until I was retired in 1974. The research at National Distillers Products Corporation was directed to the development of a commercial process for isolating glutamic acid from distillers' dried grains. The research director was Dr. Ellis C. Pattee. The project was poorly conceived and was abandoned immediately after Dr. Pattee was fired in 1947. Eventually, after two changes in research directors, I was made manager of a small research group to carry out research on liquor production and processing, a position I held until my retirement in 1945. Under my direction, the group carried out studies on whiskey composition and developed several analytical methods useful in research and distillery control laboratories. We also clarified the cause of the appearance of acrolein in alcoholic distillates. We identified more previously unidentified compounds in whiskey than any other laboratory at that time. I should restate that sentence. We found more previously unidentified compounds in whiskey than any other laboratory at that time. I collected a culture collection including bacteria, fungi, and yeast. These were cultures collected from friends, culture collections, isolated in our own laboratories, and all over. The culture was lyophilized, and the cultures were lyophilized, and specimens are available for anyone who wishes to or has any need for them. From about 1950 until 1960, I also directed the activities of the only vinegar research pilot plant in the United States. The laboratory operated both the trickling and submerged culture type of vinegar generators. The data developed from these generators were used in company publications. A publication was issued at indefinite intervals entitled The Vinegar Newsletter. It was considered quite highly by the vinegar manufacturers. Since my compulsory retirement at 65 in 1974, I have taught lecture and laboratory courses at Northern Kentucky University, Highland Heights, Kentucky. I published only two papers since my retirement. I am presently working on a third. One on the history of development of vinegar, the other describing the alcoholic fermentation process for students. This was published in the Journal of Chemical Education. I was accepted as a volunteer by the International Executive Service Corps and have served 7 consulting assignments in 5 developing countries. My most significant activity at the present time is my attempt to get this sketch completed for you. Professor Elvigem was in charge of the research which led to the isolation and identification of nicotinic acid as a preventative agent for black tongue of dogs and of pellagra in humans. The actual identification of the isolated nicotinic acid was done by D.W. Woolley, a student of W.H. Peterson. Professor Hart discovered the role of copper in nutrition and its complementary effect in iron nutrition. Others can give you more on this. Professor Peterson was very active in microbiological research. In cooperation with Professor Fred, he had at one time one of the most active research groups on the campus. He was a patient and kindly man and was very capable. His methods of research were quite similar to those used in industry at the present time. His students may not have appreciated it at the time, but after working in industry, I realized the value of his training. His criticisms were valid and well thought out. I remember him telling me, you can't organize worth a damn. I think this tape bears out the accuracy of his observation. Professor Link was well liked by his students, was a good lecturer, and did important work on the nature of disease resistance in colored onions. He is best known for his development of the rat killer, Wharf. Professor Steenbach was arrogant toward his own and other students. His primary accomplishment was the discovery that ultraviolet light converted ergosterol to vitamin D. The most outstanding student in agricultural biochem, of course, was E.L. Tatum. He shared the Nobel Prize in 1958 with George Beadle and Joshua Lederberg. Others include D.W. Woolley, who did important work on antimetabolites, that is, after he received a Ph.D. from Wisconsin. Frederick Stair, who became head of Harvard's Department of Nutrition. During M.J. Johnson's graduate studies, he was considered to be one of the most prominent of the graduate students. He became a not-too-distinguished professor in the department. In plant pathology, Professor Dixon had an active research group concerned with the disease of cereals. I know nothing of the accomplishments of this group. Professor Riker's field was the bacterial diseases of plants. He showed how the growth and development of crown gall was temperature dependent and characterized a new disease, hairy root of apple trees. As I mentioned earlier, his patience was shown by his insistence that there was a close relationship between crown gall of plants and cancer in animals. Recent advances in molecular biology have shown this view to be correct. After I left the University of Wisconsin, Professor Riker showed that the cause of the death of oak trees, the so-called staghorn effect of oak trees, was caused by a fungus disease. He received quite a bit of attention for this discovery, and was a consultant for National Distillers Products Company for some time. National Distillers had a cooperage department, of course, which used white oaks, and they were concerned about the disease of oak wilt. Besides cooperating with Professor Peterson, Professor Riker cooperated with Professor Duggar on certain problems. Professor Duggar was a quiet, self-effacing man who carried out extensive studies on tobacco mosaic virus. He prepared water-white purified extracts of tobacco plants which had been infected with tobacco mosaic virus. After W.M. Stanley of the Rockefeller Institute crystallized tobacco mosaic virus, Professor Duggar saturated his extract with ammonium sulfate. Crystals of tobacco mosaic virus were formed. He was just that close to the Nobel Prize, which was won by Stanley in 1946 for the crystallization of tobacco mosaic virus. An article on Duggar by Bishop is included with this tape. Bishop did not know about Duggar's earlier failure. Cecil Yarwood went to the University of California, Davis. One of his papers claimed that the infection of a plant with the disease raised its temperature. I have no knowledge as to whether this has been confirmed or not. One of Professor Riker's outstanding students was Armin Brown. He was the first to show that the crown gall infection of plants could produce bacteria-free galls at a location different from the site of inoculation. This was the first evidence that genes of a crown gall organism invaded the cells of the host. Department facilities. The plant pathology department was located on the second and third floors of the Horticulture Agronomy Building. The Agronomy Building was newer than the Horticulture Building and was built as a wing to the latter. The second floors of both buildings were continuous, and most of the work in plant pathology was carried out there. Good greenhouse facilities were located in the area just behind the rectangle enclosed by the two sides of the Horticulture Agronomy Building. There was one plot of land used by the plant pathology department near the building. Others were located in a field near the Forest Products Laboratory. And there are many other plots around whose location I did not know. There were not many classrooms. Most of the space was taken up with laboratories and offices. One large room on the third floor doubled as a classroom and a seminar room. There was a small room attached to the greenhouse in which tables and chairs were located. This was used for some classes. The library was located on the second floor and was quite adequate for phytopathological research. The agricultural library was located in an ag hall and was excellent. It was the only library that I know of that was open evenings and on Sundays. The experiment station was involved in some of the researches, but I have no knowledge of this. I believe that the WARF was involved in Professor Dixon's work on barley research. Departmental milestones and comparisons. The milestones and events in the history of the agricultural department, agricultural biochemistry department that I know of, are 1. Babcock's method for determining the fat content of milk and cream, 2. Hart's discovery of the interdependence of copper and iron in nutrition, 3. Steenbock's discovery that ultraviolet light converts ergosterol to vitamin D, 4. Elvis's discovery that the effect of nicotinic acid in preventing pellagra, and 5. Professor Link's discovery of the rat killer wharf. The latter occurred after I left Wisconsin. I believe that during and after World War II, significant researches were carried out on penicillin. I have no knowledge concerning the Department of Plant Pathology, Agricultural Biochemistry, nor Agricultural Bacteriology at other universities. Graduate School Administration. I have no knowledge of the administration of the College of Agriculture. I had no dealings with the administration of the colleges, with the administrators of the college, other than the heads of the two departments. My only contacts with them were in classrooms and seminars. I had the impression that the College of Agriculture operated quite independently from other colleges of the university. There was very good rapport between the Department of Chemistry and the LAS school and the Department of Agricultural Biochemistry. Graduate school milestones. I have noted the research milestone events of which I had knowledge. The only other milestone event in the College of Agriculture which I know of was the appointment of Dean Fred as Dean of the Graduate School and later President of the University. I assume that he had an influence in the promotion of Professor Elvidson to the presidency. The appointment of scientists to top administrative posts was not common in those days. President Conant of Harvard, an organic chemist, was the only other case that I knew of. I have the impression that the scientists are too objectively logical to qualify as top administrators. This applies not only to universities, but to corporations and government positions. Graduate School Administration. I have no knowledge of the administration of the graduate school under Dean Schlichter or Dean Fred. I had no personal dealings with the graduate school personnel except as a student in their classes. I have no knowledge of how the graduate school related with other schools and colleges of the university. I know of no milestone events or other themes in the history of the graduate school other than those which I have noted for the departments. The graduate school at Wisconsin was somewhat more tolerant and flexible in the requirements for a PhD degree than the graduate school at the University of Illinois. At Illinois, 1 grade of F or 2 grades of C were sufficient to disqualify a candidate for a PhD degree. One was allowed to take the foreign language examination only once at Illinois. 1 failure disqualified a PhD candidate. At Wisconsin, the foreign language requirements were much easier to meet than at Illinois. At the latter, written examinations were given in 2 languages, 1 in the candidate's chosen field, the other in a field chosen at random. At Wisconsin, I had to show proficiency only in my chosen field in 2 languages. One can read from a book which he had read before the examination. I was criticized for taking a book to the German examination which I had not read. I failed the French examination, but the professor offered to tutor me. This he did until I was able to pass the examination. Such a thing would never have happened at the University of Illinois. 5, student life, room and board. During my first year at Wisconsin, I stayed in a rooming house located at the back of a drugstore, which was located at the corner of University and Park Avenues. A bank was located across Park Street from the drugstore. The latter was located diagonally across the street from Barnard and Langdon Halls. The house was a 3-story semi-Victorian structure. The lower floor was occupied by the owner. The second and third floors were rented out to students. I had a room on the third floor. I believe the rent was $10 a month. When I arrived in mid-September 1931, the weather was beastly hot. I think Madison must be one of the hottest spots in the U.S. during a part of the summer months. Sometime during the next year, I moved to another rooming house, not far from the first one. I do not recall the exact location. It was on a street perpendicular to University Avenue. After a few months, I moved to a third rooming house located in the same neighborhood. After my roommate continued to come home heavily intoxicated every weekend. His cousin and I shared a room in this third rooming house. The next year I moved to a basement room, I think it cost only $18 a month, located on a street perpendicular to University Avenue, but located one or two streets back, that is north, of the Congregational Church. In 1933 to 1935, I lived in Adams Hall. A graduate student, I believe her name was Polly Ingram, suggested that the university fill the partially occupied dormitories with graduate assistants. Room and board was deducted from our pay. We occupied one entire house in Adams Hall. The facilities of Adams Hall were far superior to those I'd had at rooming houses, although to some they may have seemed cramped. Each room was supplied with a single bed, a study table with lamp and book rack, a wastebasket, and one chair. A portion of the room was walled off to serve as a closet. The closet had no door, but was supplied with a curtain. My salary was $60 a month, of which I, quotation mark, voluntarily, second quotation mark, waived to the university. After deducting living costs from my salary, I believe my take-home pay was about $26 a month. I saved money on this amount. Meals were served at the refectory located near Adams and Tripp Halls. 3 adequate meals were served 6 days a week, with only 2 meals on Sunday. I found it desirable to supplement Sunday's meal with a late afternoon snack, usually fried eggs and toast, at the grill located in the refectory. Each diner was allowed 2 glasses of milk and possibly coffee. There were no seconds. Prune whip was served frequently as a dessert and always produced groans of displeasure. Before moving to the dormitories, I ate at local restaurants. Lunch and dinner were approximately 35 to 40 cents each. I usually purchased a meal ticket for $5, which was good for $5.50 in meals and would last me a week. I walked from the plant pathology building to Ernie's restaurant located on Main Street because Ernie's were cheaper and served larger portions than most restaurants. The restaurant was always crowded during the noon hour. There were very few rules applicable to graduate students. Female undergraduate students were required to be in their dormitories or rooming houses by 10 p.m., except on Fridays and Saturday nights when they could stay out until 12 p.m. Prom night was another exception. Girls could stay out until 1 a.m. Rooming houses are not well adapted for study, particularly when one has a roommate. The arrangement at Adams Hall were excellent in this regard. One could lock his door and study as long as he wished. Also, the proximity of Adams Hall to the plant pathology department saved me much time. The most significant advantage of rooming at Adams Hall was that it gave me an opportunity to talk to and associate with other graduate students in biochemistry and in unrelated fields. There simply is no substitute for the exchange of ideas with fellow co-workers outside the laboratory. If the university does not now house graduate students in dormitories, it is well worth consideration. Student life, extracurricular activities. I was very much a loner in Wisconsin and attended very few social or cultural events. They were too expensive. There was a movie house just off Capitol Square in Madison. Occasionally, one of my very few friends, Cecil Yarwood, and I would walk there to see a double feature for 15 cents. I attended a few of the free movies shown at the Memorial Union on Sunday afternoons, and although I could not dance, I attended one or two dances there. I saw only one football game while I was at Wisconsin. I believe Wisconsin lost, but a Wisconsin receiver caught a spectacular pass. He was running directly away from the quarterback, looked over his shoulder, and caught the pass without turning around or hesitating. I shall always remember that play. I did not read the Daily Cardinal on a regular basis. I used the health facilities twice. Once when I had a tonsillectomy, and once for an acid burn in my eye. In both cases, the health services were excellent. I did not particularly notice the political, social, or cultural conditions of the university. One event comes to my mind. The pianist Paderewski gave a concert at the university, probably during the early months of 1932. The concert was held in the Stock Pavilion, since it was the only building large enough for the event. I was aware that there was political opposition to President Frank. I will mention this again later. There were whiskered individuals who passed out information pamphlets on the main campus. They were considered to be kooks. I don't think anyone gave any serious thoughts to their being leftists or of them posing any threat to the political system. I never saw any of these individuals on the agricultural campus. The economic conditions in Madison were perhaps a little better than in most Wisconsin cities of its size and smaller. There were very few jobs available for students. I do not recall any organization which assisted students in finding jobs. Seniors found it difficult to obtain jobs after graduation. Many returned home to their parents and took any kind of job which was available. In the plant pathology department, there were several PhDs holding postdoctoral assistantships, which they held until they could find a job. One PhD was there when I started in 1931 and was there when I left in 1936. I stayed on for a year after receiving my degree before I could find a job. Section 6, All University, Campus Leadership and Personalities. I was not aware of any particular incident associated with President Frank, except that the Capital Times called him a journalist on parole. University Library. I did not use the main Wisconsin library to any significant extent. I used the chemistry department library, located in the chemistry building, and the agricultural library, located in the basement of Ag Hall. The chemistry library was smaller than its counterpart at the University of Illinois, but it was adequate. The agricultural library was excellent by my standards. So far as I know, it was the only library which was open every evening and open 7 days a week. Women and minority group members. No one in those days had told women and minority members that they were being exploited or that they were being discriminated against. They attended classes, held assistantships along with the men. No one took advantage of them because of their sex or race. If a woman encountered a problem or task which was beyond her physical abilities, there was always a man available to help her. In industry, I have seen men refuse to help feminine libists who ask for help and freely give it to a non-liber. A woman could find a part-time job easier than could a man. Women and minority group members conducted research, presented papers, presented seminar talks, so forth, which were neither better nor poorer than those by men. There were more Oriental students, that is Chinese, Japanese, Indians, graduate students in chemistry and agriculture than there were blacks. Both undergraduate and graduate women were segregated from the men at night. a practice which I do not consider to be discriminatory or harmful. There were far more men than women at the university. This made it easier for the women to obtain dates on weekends. I was not aware of any discrimination in the admission of women. Many women in those days chose not to go to college, but instead attended a 2 to 3 year business college. A female graduate of a business college with typing and shorthand skills was almost assured of a job. This was the woman's choice, not a discrimination policy of the university. I do not recall any discussion of women's or minority group members' rights. They, women and minority group members, were in school and were accepted by fellow students and faculty alike. The students in the graduate school of the Agricultural College were more concerned about passing courses, accomplishing significant research, publishing papers, and so forth. All this rubbed off on the undergraduates. Besides, quote, I have to present a seminar paper this week, and next week we have mid-semester finals, end of quote. There wasn't time for political activity. I believe there was a fraternity at Wisconsin which accepted only Jews. I don't know whether Jews were excluded from other fraternities or not. I was not a fraternity man. Students from outside of Wisconsin were perceived and treated just as were students from Wisconsin. There was a great deal of interest in conditions in foreign countries, so foreign students found ready audiences for their conversations. Remember, there was no television in those days. Milestones and comparisons. I know of no milestones, events, or themes in the history of Wisconsin. During my stay there, Prohibition was repealed and beer became available at the student union. While in Wisconsin, I did not avail myself of the cheap beer nor the superb Wisconsin cheeses. How stupid can one be? Other comments. Thank you again for the opportunity to assist the University of Wisconsin, even though I know my contribution is of no consequence. I feel a debt of gratitude to the University of Wisconsin, one which I can never repay. The university made it possible for me to complete my studies for a doctorate degree, but I owe other debts as well for the help, encouragement, and guidance given to me by many professors, but especially by Professor Riker and Professor Peterson. Professor Riker recommended me for election to Sigma Xi, an honor which I have treasured highly over the years. He instilled in me a knowledge and appreciation of the scientific method, the courage to face life, the vision of better things to come, and a realization that persistence and industry can enable a limited individual to share in life's benefits. I'm grateful to the University of Wisconsin for my constant companion and helpmate over the past, now nearly 50 years. It happened this way. I was required to take a course in physical chemistry. When the students in my class assembled in the laboratory one day in late November 1932, a girl from the previous section was still there completing her experiment. Some of the men near me repeatedly asked me, "Who is that girl?" In order to silence my inquisitors, I walked to the girl's desk and asked if I could borrow her physical chemistry text. She assented, and I flipped the book open and noted her name and address, Gladys E. Nider, Barnard Hall. A few days later, I asked her for a date. We were married December 28, 1935, after I had received my degree. I shall be only too happy to explain or elaborate on any of the topics which I have discussed. Thank you again for helping you.